This Father's Day, celebrate the one who's always been your rock with a gift of comfort from Minky Couture. Whether he's relaxing after a long day, watching the game, or sneaking in that well-earned nap, nothing says thank you like the luxury of a Minky blanket. Soft, stylish, strong, just like Dad. Visit MinkyCouture.com or stop by a store near you and give Dad the comfort he truly deserves. Minky Couture, because even heroes need to rest.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It truly is a great bit of kit. If you can afford one, get one. You will not regret it, I promise you. I can't remember using a kettle now. It's been so long. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details. You know, also you can use it to do your vegetables as well, and your pastas and your rices, your carbohydrates. You can do it for that as well. I've learned so much from these podcasts recently. Really enjoyed the one about work and the future of work and whether we have to work and how we got to where we've got to with work. Really opened my mind actually to the way we build our society. If you hadn't had a chance to listen to that one, I really would. Real food for thought for your brain. Today's Lovejoy Hour is 15 questions to Sean Keaveney. Sean spent 14 years at BBC Six Music, and I have to say, he was brilliant. Such a fantastic broadcaster. His shows were amazing. Thoroughly enjoyed them. A real artist at work, I thought. Sad to see him leave. See him leave, hear him leave. Sad to hear him leave. Sad to see him leave, hear him leave. Not sure which one it really is. Anyway, let's hear from him now. Here's Sean. Sean, welcome so much to the podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I'm upset with you because you've left my radio set, and I'm missing it. I've got to be honest with you. I'm missing you. So can you come back, please?
A few people have said that. I think there was a petition with about 11 names on it, saying reinstate this man immediately. But we know we fucking out when I started in radio 20 years ago, I think we were in the same building back then at London's 104.9 XFM. So we're old-fashioned radio guys, aren't we? And we also understand the value of the audience and also what that relationship. So I at the risk of sounding self-aggrandizing, I've felt a lot of love. Felt a lot of love in the room, you know. And it's been really gratifying to know a lot of people miss me. But I also know that that's radio, and people, things change and people move on and all that nonsense. And people, Craig will start and everybody will love that as well, you know. So it'll just be a different gravy on the pie.
The outpouring of love towards the end, the last few weeks, must have really hit your heart hard, because you know everyone was talking about it, weren't they? I don't think I've tuned in for an actual radio show in a long time to actually make an appointment, but I tuned into your last one because I wanted to hear what you had to say, and you've done a brilliant build up with what music you were going to play at the end and your last record and all that sort of stuff. But it must have made you feel amazing that you had impact on so many of your listeners.
It did, actually. It's still happening. Because of that community element to what we do, and that happens in podcasts as well, I'm learning. People feel invested. And what's very powerful is, what I say, especially powerful, I was lucky, I would say, in that I got a breakfast show that I maintained for 11 years without going mad. And when you do a breakfast show, you're with people when they're at the most vulnerable, when they're at the most tired, when they're at the most stressed. You've got young children, possibly, or whatever. And so you make a very strong bond with those listeners then, because you're going through shit, they're going through shit. And it's very honest and lovely. And then I got lucky again. It's only answering your questions that's made me realize I got lucky again with the afternoon show for 2 years, but luck not being the correct terminology, because the luck was the pandemic, which was the worst luck the world's ever had for 100 years. But the one upside of it for me was that it afforded me another opportunity to get really inveigle my way into people's lives, and that's what ended up happening. It was such a privilege of my career to broadcast through that pandemic. And I remember my boss ringing me up at the start of it, more or less, because for a few weeks over that summer of 2020, we were on every other week. They extended the shows to 4 hours, and we did every other week, and that was weird. And then we went back to normal, but we were there throughout. And we came into Wogan House every day, and except for the 10 days when I had COVID over Christmas. Yes, I'm mentioning that again. My COVID badge of honor. But it was fucking amazing, because the things that we all went through together, and I was on air, and it was beautiful, you know. And because our show was whimsical and silly and about humor mostly and music. But there was an undercurrent of realness, you know, and of sort of caring about each other.
Mm.
And so it was bloody lovely. And I'm still getting messages now, you know, saying this is what I went through while I was listening to you. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing I'll never take for granted, you know.
Mm, I loved your speech, right? And, you know, your last link, it was really poignant and made a lot of sense, and especially about radio. And I'll tell you something interesting, because, you know, every now and then I send you a message saying, you know, love your show, love what you do, whatever. And sad to see you leaving. And during the pandemic, I realized that every dinner time I sat down with my daughter and I was listening to the radio, and Steve Lamatt was on. And one day he didn't reply, by the way, but I emailed him and said, thanks for being in my ear at dinner time. Cause it's sort of just, there's something about hearing familiar voices, yours and Lamatt and everybody else. The radio feels like your friend, doesn't it? And I worry about my daughters who never listen to the radio. Everything's on demand. They don't have that, which is that friendship with the radio DJ like we do.
I agree. I mean, I've got a lot of worries. I've got a lot of worries. And, you know, with three young kids in the world, it does make you concerned, because it's like, you're right, it's... Like my eldest, he loves winding me up. You know, he's 13, and he's like, you know, he loves to like get into something on Netflix and then just bosh it all in an afternoon. And then he's like, that's the way we do things now, Dad. You know, it's not the 80s where you had to wait for bloody week for another episode of Hill Street Blues. Get over it. And he's sort of winding me up, because he knows that there's a value to both. But that is a concern. And I think that the way that I hear it a lot across radio, it's that there's not quite enough. It's like radio as a medium hasn't got the confidence it should have in what it's really good at, which is what you've just described. That relationship, the live relationship, it's all very well building playlists and going to BBC Sounds or whatever the receptacle is for, you know, to go into Spotify, listening to podcasts. Absolutely amazing. I've got a couple myself, of course, which I'll be boring people about later, but there's nothing, like you've just said, like live connection. And especially during a pandemic when people are ill, like when you've got COVID a lot of the time, or when you're ill, or maybe you're suffering from whatever, or you're a bit sad, maybe you live on your own, you put that radio on and it's a bloody relationship. And it's...
Nothing annoyed me more than when I was working in music radio at X or something, and they'd say, this music's researching well, or we're looking at the research. It's like, I used to always think, fuck the research, they want to hear the people speak. That's why you tune in, because you want to tune in and have a friend there who then also plays music. Mm-hmm. And people get so caught up in the idea that the playlist is important, and it just really, I think having good music is important, but I just think that the DJ in between the songs is as important, if not more important. Yeah. I've got 15 questions here for you. We'll never get through them all. We never do, but let's start, and then we can go through, and we can also talk about your podcast on the journey, because I'd like to hear about those. Right. What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been valuable to your life?
Love these questions, by the way. I like these questions as well, by the way, before I start, because as somebody who's interviewed hundreds, if not thousands of people, it's nice to have a contained question. Instead of like a, what I do, like a sort of rambling chat, it's nice to have a beginning, middle and end, and then you think about it. So the advice, right. Well, apart from, I mean, what, one of the ones that I would throw in to begin with would be, because it's surprising how many people don't know this, if you've got a tube of something and you're wondering what that spike is at the end of the plastic cap, it is, you're supposed to turn it around and use that to pierce the film lid of the tube that you're clutching in your right hand. I didn't find that out until I was 41.
Wow.
I've got a feeling that you probably, I'm sure you know that, Tim, but I bet that there's at least 15% of your listeners who didn't know that.
Right.
So that's one thing I would say right off the bat.
That's up there with Suggs's.
What did he say?
So Suggs's advice, which I love, is doesn't matter whether you think you do or you don't, before leaving the pub, make sure you go to the toilet.
Oh, and don't speak to man. Who knows? Face facts. One of the great Camden men. But I would say something a little deeper, which is, again, a bit fucking hell.
Oh, Sean, you're just breaking up there. What did you say?
If that happens again, tell me, and I'll have to go and move nearer the server.
All right, and I think you're all right now. So just go back. Okay. You just got to the bit where you're about to tell us that bit of advice.
I start buffering when this really sage piece of advice comes. I was going to say, it's a bit embarrassing. I'm probably going to end up sounding a bit like a sort of shit Deepak Chopra. But, I read this quite recently, and I don't know who it was who wrote it. Probably somebody really, some great author like D.H. Lawrence or somebody. I don't know who it was. But it was a lovely little line, and it said something like, remember that all the boring, this bit is definitely paraphrasing this great writer because it's not what they would have said, but all those moments of your life, the boring ones, the bits when you're sitting outside the dentist and you're waiting, you're walking up the street to go and get a pint of milk, these are the moments of your life. And it really struck me because I'm a very, like everybody, you know, we're busy people. We're always thinking about the next thing we got to do. And it's all like mindfulness bollocks, isn't it? But it's not bollocks. It's really true. It's like, I talk to my kids about this a lot because they're basically atheists, you know, even though they're like the older ones, 10 and 13. They're all about the Big Bang and science and shit. But, you know, when we're having deeper chats, like sometimes they'll say, yeah, you know, like, but maybe like heaven is like now, isn't it? It's like we're alive and we're breathing. And it doesn't matter how tedious the day becomes or how shit, you know, I have to sort my council tax out or something. You're fucking alive. Mm. That is mind blowing. And that's it, really.
These are great conversations you're having with your kids. I actually agree with that sentiment exactly, by the way. And I always say to people, if you get on the tube and you don't look at your phone and you don't read a book and you just watch the other humans, you'll get so much out. It's like a zoo. Watching humans is so surreal. And I just think that is a pleasurable moment when you actually take that opportunity to get on the tube and do nothing. Absolutely. And that is kind of a bit of mindfulness. Let's get on to the next question. What's the best moment of your career?
Well, again, let's go Deepak. It's yet to come. But that's facetious. Let's, because what I've worked out is if I was lucky, I'm maybe halfway through my broadcasting career, right? Or maybe not even quite halfway. I could be like really lucky, and a combination of lucky and unlucky. Like none of us are ever going to be able to retire. We simply won't be able to do that because of the way the world is now. So there's not going to be any golf and yachting for me. I'm going to be working to the grave. So, you know, if I was lucky, I might get another 20, 30 years out of it. But I would say in a very funny way, the best moment of my career so far has been what's just happened, which was the end of my tenure at the BBC, what we touched on before, and I've said this once or twice before in different ways, I've been given an opportunity to, it's almost like watching what happens after you die. I've by leaving a thing that we all built together that was beautiful, for whatever reasons, I got to witness that love reciprocate. I got to witness it come back to me, and for people to tell me what we did together meant to them. And that was, and I keep going on about it because it's so powerful to me, life-changing actually. It's like, that's emboldened me, made me feel, because, you know, a lot of the time when, you know what it's like, a lot of the time when you're doing, especially like a daily radio show, it's a grind a lot of the time. It's fucking hard. It's like people, and I, being a sort of working class northern man, I underestimated it myself. I was like, oh, fucking 15 hours a week. 15 hours, mate. You want to try fucking 45. You want to try 60 hours down the pit. And I was like, but it's different. It's like sort of Cat Lives or something when you're on air. 1 hour is like 3 hours. And to have done it for that long and been in the company of these people for so long, you build something and it's amazing. And I got to see it and I had it represented back to me as a kind of like, thanks for doing this. And it's made me feel amazing. And so that's definitely been like the best moment so far, even though it's kind of conversely like an end of a big part of my career as well.
It is what you do, by the way, is really hard work. When I did radio, I first of all started on a daytime slot on X and I was on my own. And after about a year, I got to the stage where I was like, I can't even be bothered to lift the mic during the records because I'm so bored of my own voice. I've got nothing to say anymore. And it's like, if I hadn't thought of a good question that day or some interaction with the listener, which became so important for material, I just used to think, oh shit, I'll just sweep another record. Yeah. And the producer would go, Tim, you just done five in a row. And I'm like, shit, have you noticed? But then, so I just always used to build teams around me. So I always had people to play off. And I know you have Matt and stuff, but you were doing it on your own. And that's why you built that relationship with the listener so that you had material and everything. So it worked out wonderfully for you.
I think we had a mutual, didn't my friend Andy Ashton produce your show for a while? Yeah.
Yeah. Tremendous. Good guy. So why have you left then?
Well, okay, I'll be as concise about it as possible. And people do want to know, so I suppose it's only right to sort of talk about it as best, as clearly as possible. It's simply that the station started to, I think, have slightly different ideas as to what it wanted to do at different parts of the days. And there's no other way of looking at it or saying it other than the truth, I think, which is, I think that the people, the guys in charge looked at my slot and just thought, it's not really doing it for me anymore. You know, I think that maybe we could try something different here other than the Sean Keaveney thing. So they basically asked me in and said, look, we want you to do something. We don't want you to do your show anymore. We want you to do something else. And the something else was, I think it's fair to say, a considerably less of a commitment than what I had, and I didn't want to do it. So I did leave. I wasn't sacked. I did leave. However, you know, that show would stop being available to me. Right. You know what I mean? They said, we want somebody else to do that show, so you can do something else. And the other thing wasn't that great, so I left.
So you're doing podcasts now. And I think that's a bad decision, by the way. You'd have to comment from the bosses, because I love your show. It was one of the things that I always tuned in for. But you're doing podcasts now. What's interesting is when you listen to the Americans talk about it, they're talking about podcasts being the new radio. It seems to evolve this way. We love our radio over here because we have the BBC. It's really powerful still, isn't it? However, in America, I think podcasts are really taking over. They're starting to take over here. Do you think you're seeing a shift towards podcasting over here as a radio DJ?
Yeah, I do. And like we're saying, I'm not 100% comfortable with that, because I think everything can live together in a beautiful harmony, you know, like the song says. And I'm a late adopter to everything, right? I got offered about 7 backstage passes to see Oasis before I finally decided that they were all right in 1995. And then Gwigsy got stomach bug and we couldn't go. So the point of that story is I'm a late adopter, and I'm a late adopter to podcasts as well. But now I'm listening to them a lot more. And I'm doing a couple as well. I really see the value in it, which I didn't before, because I was just a radio guy before. So I've got that dual perspective on it, having done both. And I like what both offer. I think that the they are quite different things, aren't they? You know, like a podcast is like a sort of smaller audio version of like a Netflix series to me, or something like that. Or it's something that is made and it lives on a server and you can access it when you feel like it. And the really popular ones, obviously the ones that grind week in, week out, and they're always spitting them out. And so that's a bit more like radio, where it's like you can rely on that content. It's always coming. And I think that's brilliant. And obviously podcasts do things in better than radio in some ways, like in-depth conversations, they do better. I'm still getting used to that, doing mine, that I can relax. I can talk for a bit longer if I want, you know. Mm. Whereas when I was in radio, it was like I thought if my link went on longer than 5 minutes, I was boring the fuck out of people, you know, and they'd play a song. And obviously that's not what you do with podcasts. But like we said before, and you're right, I think, the BBC is peerless in the world when it comes to live radio broadcasting. And even though I've temporarily stepped off the bus, I'll step back on point, and I'd love to do it in some part of the BBC. I really hope they don't throw the baby out of the bathwater and start saying it's all about BBC signs now, it's all about playlists, it's all about podcasts. Because if they do, they're doing that thing that a lot of organisations have done over the years, and they're not learning the lesson, which is they don't see what they intrinsically are good at. Mm. I've even had conversations with people at Spotify, like quite high up, who are sort of like, I don't think the BBC understand how great they are at that thing that we can never really do.
Well, it's funny with podcasting, because you start doing your podcasting and it was all sort of, I don't know, it all felt very independent. Then BBC Sound sort of stepped into the marketplace and they just dominate because it's the BBC and they can advertise, but also they put out a good product and people know where they can get it from. Just going back to your radio show, though, when I was thinking about talking to you, it occurred to me that, I don't know what's happening with Radio 1 at the moment, because I don't really listen to it, but that used to be the breakfast show, obviously, years ago. And, but younger people are not tuning in like they used to, are they? They're looking for on demand. They're going onto their phones and they're listening to their Spotify accounts or their iTunes accounts or whatever. And the older people are listening to the radio. And I think the beauty of Six Music, because at one stage they were going to get rid of it, weren't they? Yeah. And the perfect storm was we all migrated to Six Music because I just felt I felt like Radio 2 wasn't doing it for me. So we all migrated there, and there was you sitting there in the breakfast slot who was our humour and our reference points. And it was just that perfect storm, wasn't it, for people of our age group going, wow, what, we've got something here. And then we felt ownership of it. Great music, great interviews, great cast of DJs. Yeah.
I do think that there's a whole nomad element to a big part of the radio landscape listenership now, who don't really know where to go. And like you say, Two's doing its thing, but I think it's trying to appeal to, you know, the sort of Heart FM crowd a little bit sometimes, which is fine. That's what they want to do. Incidentally, Greg James is one of the great broadcasters of our times. On One Breakfast, and he's, if anybody's going to keep at the vanguard and keep getting younger people into it, it's him, because he's fucking brilliant. But you're right, there is this kind of shift in listening, and I don't know what, because one of my theories is, and it's not just, I think my missus was talking to me about this, it's like if we could all hold our nerve in radio and just, instead of panicking and thinking, fucking hell, my kids don't listen to the radio at all, it's dead. It's like, yeah, but they don't know. But maybe it's something that people grow into. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't listen to the radio that much, actually. I wasn't one of these radio head kids, apart from Alan Bezick's show on Red Rose Radio, which I was obsessed with because he used to, like, really abuse the listeners. It was brilliant. But apart from that, I didn't really listen to the radio. It's something that happens. It's a theory of mine that it comes to you a bit later. when you're younger, you just want music. You want to be seen to be cool. It's when you get into your 20s and into your 30s, you're more sedentary. You're cooking tea. You know, maybe you've got a kid on the way or something. You're housebound a lot more. You're in the car. Radio comes into its own. So why people are just pandering only to the youngsters and thinking, if we don't get them, radio's dead, I don't know. And I think it's a mistake.
I'm going to come to your podcast in a minute, but whilst we're here, I'm going to ask one of my questions that, because you got there, what were you like at school? You might as well tell us about what you were like at school.
God, I'd love... Right, this is my memory of it, and my memory's very poor, to say the least, but I remember that I was quite a compliant kid. I wasn't a naughty kid. I come from a massive family, and my uncle, who is only 2 years old, my youngest uncle, who's only 2 years older than me, was technically then my sort of brother and best mate. You know, I've got a younger brother as well, 6 years younger than me. And the reason I mention that is, I think, because I wasn't a sort of tearaway, or, you know, I was quite a good kid, boringly. Did not like school much until I got to about 14. And then, you know, I always say this to my kids, you know, you meet your people. At some point, you meet your people. And it's because it's really painful watching your kids go to school and not really always click with everybody. And they think it's going to be like that forever. It's like, no, it's not. You're going to find your peeps. And when you find your people, off you go. And weirdly, the people that I found when I was 14, 15, 16 are still amongst my best friends now. You know, we're still all together. So then it became different. When we were in sixth form, our personalities really started to form. We used to do really dumb shit, Tim. Like, if I described some of the things we did, you would just think, what a bunch of dickheads. Like, me and my mate Al used to go down to the canteen when we were 16. And I would sit at one end of the canteen and he would sit at the other. And it was a big canteen, it was a big school. And we did a thing called spacious eating, where we would have conversations as though we were sitting next to each other, but we were actually 150 meters apart. And we thought that was fucking brilliant. But obviously, everybody else thought we were bellends, which is probably nearer the truth. We had a thing called Board of Death on the stairs of the sixth form common room, which was just a wobbly board with Board of Death written on it in chalk. And we'd the first person would grab it, and then we'd sort of corner somebody on the stairs and just like wobble the Board of Death at them, because we thought that was funny, Tim. We were fucking weirdos. And consequently, we weren't very popular with the opposite sex either.
Were you into any of the cult fashions, mod, punk, skinhead, whatever?
We were embarrassing, man. I've talked about this to somebody recently. Like, I was 16 in 1989, 17. And that was a halcyon year for me. I just started up as sixth. I was in love with Juliette Wood. And she wouldn't. She was not interested in me. And we were massively into the Stone Roses and shit like that, you know, and the Happy Mondays. We were all in bands. So we were playing our indie pop around the local pubs in Lee, drinking pints of bitter. Our local cocktail was called a Bitter Brown Split, which is half a pint of bitter and half a bottle of Man's Brown Ale. And so we were doing that whilst our peers were getting off their tits on MDMA and the Hacienda and, you know, watching 808 State and watching the Stone Roses actually playing. But we missed out on all that stuff. So we were embarrassing. You know, my wife saw a picture of me and my first girlfriend recently from when I was about 19. And she literally did a double take. And she was like, sorry, I thought that was like your dad then for a minute. You look like a pair of geography teachers, which is what we look like. You know, it was tragic. I mean, talk about peaking. I say this a lot to kids. Don't peak too soon. Meaning, don't be one of those cool kids who's like cool and hot when they're 15 and like everybody wants to be them. You think that's a good idea, peaking at 15, your bell end? I don't. I think you want to save that peak until you're in your 30s or 40s. And I'm still waiting for mine, Tim.
It's coming any minute now. Anyway. Right, tell us about your podcast. You've got a couple, haven't you? Is it two or three you're doing?
Fucking hell, too many, I think. Too many. What I've got at the moment is, what I've got at the moment on the marketplace is we've got one called The Lineup, which is my good friend Matt Everett is part of this. You know, it's his idea, really. It's and he's just got me in as pure talent, pure raw talent. And it's basically it's an old idea, but it's like the, you know, the fantasy festival. It's like the fancy dinner party. And that sounds quite a workmanlike idea, but it's quite magical, really. You get people talking. We basically say we want five acts, living or dead, and I'm going to be your festival genie, and I'm going to pick you up, and it's going to be through the arc of a day, and it starts at daybreak, and then it goes on, and you're to plot this perfect day, and we end up talking about everything. You know, we end up talking about what carbs you want, you know, who's in your festival crew. And then it gets a bit emotional. Obviously, you're talking about why is that music so resonant to you, and that takes you down different paths. And we've had some amazing people. Like Jodie Whittaker's done one; she was incredible. There's a great. She was quite new to me until recently. Joy Crooks. We've got my creatures coming up. We've got Carl Cox and people like this. Dan Reynolds from Imagine Dragons, right? As a Six Music guy, I'd never really listened to him or anything. You know, my kids knew about him. But they're one of the biggest fucking bands in the world. This dude's amazing. Like, we had this chat in Nevada. I was in the pissing rain in Soho. And he just opened up. He's like this sort of ex-Mormon guy who puts on LGBTQ plus festivals himself now. And he's got this ridiculous stories about putting big red handprints all over Daft Punk's white suits at the Grammys and everything, you know. So it's nice. It's nice for me to do what you're doing now, which is just shoot the shit with these people.
Yeah, it's good. What I love the concept of that is, as soon as you say it, I'm visualizing stuff that I want to see at a festival. And the moment that I always think, I mean, I'd immediately go for Madness because everyone can sing along to it. You know? And I'd immediately go for The Specials because they're my favorite band of all time. I always remember, was it Jay-Z who came out of Glastonbury? Was it Jay-Z who came out and started by singing an Oasis song?
Wonderwall, yeah.
And it was the worst thing he could have done because we're all like, yes, Oasis song, sing along. And then he goes into his music, which is great. And I like, you know, I don't mind Jay-Z, but I was like, he was like, this is what you could have won. Yeah. Instead of singing along drunk, you can have me instead. And I was like, oh, mate, why'd you do that? I want Oasis. I can sing the songs along.
Yeah, yeah. We're old, aren't we? I remember one of my festival memories is Friday afternoon stroke evening at Glastonbury and walking into you, actually.
Yeah, no, my mates are all like, this is Sean Keaveney, let's go and have a chat. I kind of know him a bit, so let's go and have a chat. So, yeah.
Friends, mate. Yeah. And then I will give you 9 seconds on Sean Keaveney's creative cul-de-sac coming up soon, which is basically like me talking bullshit on a microphone in my top room, going through 20 years of my failed sitcom comedy column ideas, and then I do it with a guest and we go through all of their notebooks as well, and that's going to be amazing. But that's coming up like in a month or two.
They're all great. I mean, as you say, the great thing about podcasting is it's a long form chat. You know, if we were doing a radio show, we'd be sweeping music in between this and everything, and I've got a good solid hour here of just sitting chatting to you, which people all love to consume. And I think that's the great thing about podcasting. Well, let's get on to your next question. What does success mean to you?
Got these. Okay, I've got one for this.
Actually, Sean, I'm just going to pause you there because I'm supposed to do this. My producer keeps telling me. Let's take an ad break and we'll come back with your answer to that.
That's good.
And we're back. Sean, what's the answer to your question? What does success mean to you?
What's illuminating about this conversation that you're taking me through is that you're making me realize how much cliche I taught by accident, but also how much stuff I learn off my own kids. I guess that's an interesting thing because I end up talk so much shite in the car, especially with the poor kids, you know. But then sometimes I think, oh, some of this is good stuff. And like, with what I say to them, and so what I end up realizing is the answer to your question is, you know, because you know what kids are like, especially now, it's all like, how much money does he earn? This YouTuber earned £600 million last year. You know that. And what have you earned, Dad? You know, you're taking the piss and you say he's got blue hair, but he earned £600 million last year. What have you earned? You know, all this bollocks. The kids are like, it's all they're all about like numbers. 6 million weekly listens. How many have you got? You know, stats. But in my defense, like to him, I'm like, look, fine. The only real metric for success, in my view, this is when you can see them mentally turning off, is this is the metric, is that if you get to adulthood and you can earn a living, which we have to do in this world, I hate to say it, I wish there was a universal basic income. I wish that we could just go to the library or sit on the beach and rub each other's feet and rear livestock, you know, and all that stuff. But we can't. We live in this fucking capitalist world. We've got to earn a crust. But success to me is, if you can do that, doing something that you like, you don't even have to, it doesn't even have to be like, I'm Stephen Fry and I'm living my best life. You can just be like, I don't feel like I'm owned by somebody and just doing something that's soul destroying. So I think that's success for me. And I know, I don't get me wrong, I realize that for a lot of people, that's what life is. It's a fucking bastard and it's a bind. And you have to go and work for this dickhead that you hate or this company that you think are pricks. But and that's not to say that that life is not a success, because you can do it in other ways. You know, there's family, of course, you know, which is just about the most important thing on earth. But like, for me, that's how it looks, is like being able to get to Sunday night. This is a litmus test for me. Get to Sunday night and have you got that knot in your stomach and that panic of fucking hell, I just don't know I'm going to be able to do this next week without killing that person, or you know, without feeling really sad. That's what success looked like to me. And I've so far, I've cracked it. I mean, this is not to say that I won't be doing swing shifts at the local coffee shop.
Well, I tell you what, let me ask you another question, because I was in that life of turning up to do, I worked in finance, clothes shops, bars. I did a lot before I got into broadcasting. And I'd had that dread of going into work that I absolutely hated it. And it was such a motivation for me. And I tell my children this all the time when they tell me that I'm lucky all the time. And I said, I'm not lucky. I was desperate. Yeah. I realized that I couldn't do it. And, you know, I had a realization that I wasn't going to be a footballer. Very late, actually. And too late. And then I was like, what the fuck can I do? Because I cannot do this constantly. Sorry, someone at my door. I cannot do this constantly. So it was this massive desperation that, yeah, I had to go, right, I've got to do something. I can talk. Let's get myself into broadcasting. Someone's got to do that job. So I've been in that position, and it is really horrible, isn't it? Have you had normal jobs which you've absolutely despised doing?
Yeah. One of the best things my mum did, because my mum is, I'm almost like an Italian son, really, if you can imagine such a thing. Like, even though we're from Lancashire, you know, I don't think my parents would disapprove of my description of my upbringing as a bit cosseted, really. You know, we had a big family, and my mum and dad did everything for us, especially my mum. And she protected me from all... You know, a bit too much sometimes. I'm fucking useless at so many things for that reason. But, you know, I'm nearly 50 now. I should have sorted it out. But one of the things that she did when I was 19, I dropped out of uni because I missed my girlfriend and came back to live at home. And my mum, at some point, obviously, had had enough. And she said one afternoon when I was lodging about on the couch with another cup of tea, "Hey, I tell you what, love, I've got you a job at Press Bar starting next week." So Press Bar Die Castings, Ducie Street, Manchester, was like the seventh circle of hell. My uncle Kenny was a director there. My other uncle Paul was a tool fitter there. It was an aluminium parts factory. And my mum obviously just spotted that I could become a fucking layabout forever if I wasn't. So she got me a job on the shop floor doing a thing called linishing,
which is like a very fast moving belt, and it was like parts of like roof racks and stuff, you know, like sort of curved pieces of metal, but they had like seams on them, and I had to sort of turn them on this belt and make them smooth, and then chuck it into a thing, and then get another one, and I had to do like thousands of these things a day, you know. And I only did it for about 9 months, but that was it for me. A bit like you, I was like desperation. Then I was like, if I don't focus and on something that I think I'm good at, I'm fucked. My time is going to be taken up by Ian Reid over there, the fucking guy with a fag hanging out of his mouth, saying, "Why have you not done 2,000 yet?" You know, I'd standing outside the toilet when I was having a shit. Have you finished in there? You know, we all know it. We've all been there. You're the company man, and they've got your time. So that was my then realization that I was desperate and I had to do something.
Sure, number
doing copywriting, radio copywriting. That's how I ended up at XFM.
Oh, what's radio copywriting? What does that mean?
Just literally writing radio ads.
Right.
Berkshire's Better Music Mix, 210 FM.
Perfect. Love it. I must say I get embarrassed when I talk about my career because I do love it. My job, because I love it so much. And it does get embarrassing because people just think, oh, you're lucky to have it. And I am lucky to have it. I've done two podcasts on work, one with Bruce Daisley, who is the European CEO or something of Twitter, and one with Matthew Taylor, which is the last podcast I did. And both of them say the sort of, to use Sean's expression here, the bell ends aren't really the people who are going to do the jobs. They're the people who've created the jobs to be so horrific that people don't want to go to them. Yeah. And no jobs need to be like that. All jobs can be fun to go to. I've worked in bars that I've absolutely loved because the atmosphere is great and everybody's enjoying it. And so, you know, it's been a pleasure to be there, but I've done so many jobs where the bosses are just horrific. And you say you've on the clock constantly. It's just really horrible, and that's what made me desperate. So yeah,
desperation is the engine of inspiration.
Good. I like that a lot. Okay, let's go on to another one of my questions then. Should we do what's the worst moment of your career? Have you got one of those? What's
the worst moment of my career? Yeah. Oh, it was. Well, I mean, what one of them is perversely is the same answer as what's the best moment of your career. You know, I could say, to be not glib but serious, like leaving Six Music was the worst and the best moment at the same time. So I would offer that. But then I would, just to keep it on a more prosaic level, I'll never forget, I think it was so there's a wonderful woman called Leslie Douglas who got me into the BBC. And she used to be the controller of Six Music and Radio 2. And she talent spotted me and dragged me over. I've never been talent spotted before or since, really.
Except hold on, but how did you end up on from a copywriter to DJ?
Well spotted, because I was just going to correct myself. The aforementioned Andy Ashton, he was a talent spotter, and he was the first guy to get me on air. When I was writing radio ads, he was like, "You don't want to do that. You want to be on air. We've got this slot midnight to six on Sundays into Monday. Why don't you do that?" And I was like, "Yeah, all right." So I've got him to thank for that, even though a 6-hour live show at midnight on a London station is not for the faint-hearted. But fast forward 6 years, Leslie Douglas gets me into Six Music. I've arrived. This is amazing. It's a fledgling, one of the best stations in the world. I feel great. And then I remember leaning over to me conspiratorially during a dinner once and saying, "Within a year, I'll have you on Radio 2. And she was good as her word, right? She got me on I used to sit in for Dermot O'Leary a few times on Radio 2, and that was a thrill because it's such a big station. But then one Saturday, Tim, this gets to the point, she said, the wonderful Stuart McConey used to do a Saturday afternoon Radio 2 show as well. And he used to do it from whatever it's called, the mailbox in Birmingham, this BBC place in Birmingham. And she said, "Could you stand in for Stuart this particular Saturday?" And I said, "Yeah, all right." But it was a perfect storm of, I was feeling a bit low on confidence anyway at this time. because my breakfast show wasn't going very well. And, you know, the producers I was working with at the time, we weren't gelling, and I was feeling, and my first baby was on the way. And I was really feeling the pressure. I was really feeling like depressed and worried about my job and everything. But I knew I couldn't turn it down. So I went up to Birmingham, went into this alien studio that I didn't really know how it worked, with these producers who were, I'd never met before, who were lovely people, but we didn't have any relationship. And, you know, when you're doing a big, when you're doing a radio show, you need that. And it was the worst, I think it was 3 hours. I think it was the worst 3 hours of my broadcasting life, without question, because I knew it was going out nationally. I knew everybody was listening that might be important to me. And it was just a fucking car crash, Tim. I just couldn't really, I couldn't speak. You know, I don't know if you've ever done it, but sometimes when you put the mic up and it's live radio, and maybe something's happened in your life, or maybe your confidence, the floor just drops out, and you like it's a trap door underneath you, and you're just flailing. And it's like, yep. Hang on a minute, I've got another 19 links to do.
Yeah, I've been there.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How does it feel?
And you end up talking over the intro or the singing, when the vocals hit and everything is a mess. Yeah. And
everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
We had the wonderful, we even had John Shuttleworth, Graham Fellows, one of my good mates. And he was on the show, but I had to pre-record the interview, and I fucked that up. I mean, he kind of saved it because he was being old John. But I was like, I had to apologize to him after. I'm saying, I'm so sorry. I've lost my mind. And I went to the pub with a couple of people afterwards when I got back to London. I was like, I think I've just ruined my career. But of course, you've got no perspective at all at that point.
Yeah.
So that was one that really sticks out. But I would say I had those kinds of shows relatively regularly when I was at six. You know, I got to a point where I was quite zen about it. I was like, about 11% of your shows are going to be shit, and you've just got to be okay with it.
Yeah, well, you're doing so many of them. That's the thing. You know what you've made me realize doing this? I love doing podcasts because you get to think so much, and then you can try and talk it through with you. But working in radio and TV, we have things called gatekeepers, which are people who put you on. So in the case of XFM, I've just discussed this with Christian O'Connell recently on this podcast. Is there's a guy called Andrew Phillips who went to me one day, do you want to come and do a radio show? I'd never done it before. I was crap, but he kept with me, and he kept on saying, you've got to paint pictures. And he was brilliant. He got me over, Dermot over, he got Christian over. I'm sure he gave you your job.
Yeah,
and then what made me realize is when I was not working that well during the daytime, and I said, like, I can't do it, they moved me to nighttime. I shared a slot with Zane Lowe. They said, go and work with Andy Ashton. Andy Ashton, I now realize, he was the guy who went, let's do something exciting, and then bothered to put the effort in. And you've got to find someone who can be bothered to put the effort in as well, because too many people will just go, I can't be arsed with that. You know what it's like as producers. And you've just made me realize how that show I did with him, we had Slash on it. We had a myriad of bands, and we had all sorts of great things, and he got sponsors in, and the guy worked really hard. I'm so glad that you say talent spotting, because he was one of the ones who helped me when we got Carl Pilkington in on my show. He was the one, he said, come on, let's get him in. And so, you know, so it was like, he was very open to ideas, and that makes all the difference when you meet people like that. They're the real unsung heroes of broadcast, aren't they?
They truly are. It's like being a music producer, I guess. You know what I mean? You can have John, I always end up with talking about the Beatles. You could have John Lennon come in with his scrappy little bit of acoustic guitar and the first few lines of Strawberry Fields. And it's like, you are a genius. That is brilliant. I could never have thought of that. However, it still sounds a bit shite until George comes along, you know, George Martin, and says, I think we'll have a bit of Mellotron here, and then we'll have a bit of brass. You know, it's like you need those people as well as the pure creatives to make the picture, to paint the picture, don't you?
Yeah. I'm going to change tack now. One of my questions, because I want to make sure I don't run out of time for this one. It's my favorite one. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Oh, my God. Well, okay. Well, I'll tell you, I can answer this like, no, but I'm surprised that I haven't, in a way. Like, I think it's a really interesting question because, like, when I was on my radio program, I used to have Brian Cox on most weeks, Professor yep. Brian Cox, and he always used to shut these down. It was so funny. I remember doing a Q&A with him once at one of his book launches, and I think I asked him something like, "I said, this is it. I said, right, Brian, well, I've got you here, mate. Isn't it possible that when somebody says they've seen a ghost, what they've actually been witness to is the clashing of two parallel dimensions. That you've got this dimension that we're on, this plane, this part of the universe, but there's one underneath it and one above it, and they've clashed. And it's almost like, you know, the past and the future have come together in the present." And he's just like, "Let me just stop you there. That's fucking bullshit." So he wasn't buying that, right?
Sean, every time I interview him, I always ask him either, it annoys my viewers so much as well. I'll either go flat earth, right? They've got a point, haven't they? Or I do aliens, because he just hates it, doesn't he? He hates even anyone saying anything like that. And the viewers go, "You don't take him seriously enough." And it's like, he's fine with it. He has a laugh, doesn't he? I love him.
Amazing. But the thing is, of course, that's not the term I would use. Like, but extraterrestrial conscious beings, I think that most physicists would agree, are out there. They're just too far fucking away for us to ever find them, or than to find us. You know, they're probably hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of light years away. So the next in time. So, but I haven't seen them, but I don't doubt for a minute that they're out there. As for ghosts, yeah, I don't know.
Adam Rutherford and Hannah Fry have written this great book, and in it, it's like the it's called something like Everything You Need to Know About Everything or something like that. I can't actually remember. I'll look it up in a minute. But in it, they talk about what aliens would actually look like. I'm trying to look it up whilst I'm speaking to you. What aliens would actually look like. And what was interesting, they say if aliens are in sort of like, say they're in the equivalent of a liquid, then they could be like a whale. They might be huge, like a blue whale, and have no legs. But if they do have legs, they probably won't have two legs. They'll probably have six legs, because we're the only things which really walk around. And you start thinking, wow, this is really interesting stuff, because we just assume they're going to look like us and come down in spaceships. But I do think they're out there. And I talk to my friends all the time about it and say, "Can you just talk me off this subject a bit, because I'm going too deep now that I constantly are looking for signs that aliens are here." I'm aware that it's probably bollocks, but I do love it.
Because it's like, as long as there's carbon, as long as there's, you know, as long as those things that give life are out there in the universe, then conscious life could occur. And like you say, if it's on a gas giant or something, it could just be something that looks like a fucking blimp, but it's got a super brain. You know, we have got no idea, and it's out there somewhere.
Yeah. Right. I want to ask you another question, right? When I worked in radio, always the ultimate, and we know this, is the breakfast show. So you've got a few breakfast shows knocking around, obviously Radio 1, Radio 2, and we're talking music radio. Capital was always huge, wasn't it? You had Six Music, obviously, is a massive one. Virgin, for a step, but Virgin kept changing it. Virgin, Absolute, Virgin. I can't work out what was going on there. But when you actually got the call of Six Music, that must have been just a momentous time. How did you feel when you'd gone from copywriter to DJ overnight to breakfast show at BBC Six Music? Well, I mean, it must have been amazing.
It was, Tim. It was a great thrill. And obviously, I don't know. I was a relatively young man then. Well, I wasn't that young, actually. I was in my mid-30s even then. But yeah, I got from penury to, you know, being one of the BBC's big presenters, you know. And it was incredible. What a fucking journey. Because I remember just 6 years before, I came to London at the end of the year 2000 and started doing this 3 till 6:30 a.m. on XFM overnight slot, which I did for 3.5 years. But I remember very vividly doing a good old-fashioned demo tape and putting it in a jiffy bag and putting it on the desk of old BH. You know, and it said something like, "For the attention of," I don't know who the controller was then, Andy Parfitt or something. And I genuinely remember walking off down Lower Regent Street and thinking, well, give it 6 months, right, and I'll be in there, not realizing how fucking hard it is to get any recognition in this business, you know, at all. And so when I got the call that they wanted me to do breakfast, it was mind blowing. And I think I did sort of take it for granted as well. You know what I mean? I think now you've asked me that question and I reflect on it, I feel it differently than I did at the time. I think at the time it was more, yeah, well, great. You know, I've been doing pretty well these last couple of years and this is the trajectory I'm on. But looking back on it as a nearly 50-year-old fella, I mean, how nice to be offered a breakfast show. Like, us fuckers aren't going to get that again, probably. You know what I mean? I don't think so. It was great. It's a lovely moment to have had.
Yeah. I was talking to Christian O'Connell about this, actually, the pressure on radio. It's really funny because in TV, there's the awards. I'm just not remotely interested in them. And then there's the ratings. They're sort of all right-ish. But in radio, for some reason, when I worked at it, the Sonys were so huge that you see DJs wanting to kill each other on them, and the Rajars, which is such a bizarre thing. I think it's still people ticking boxes in books, isn't it, or something?
Yeah.
And the Rajars, when they came out, it's so funny because it's reminded me all of a sudden I'd get a call of Andy Ashton or someone going, our Rajars are good, our Rajars are bad or something. You know, they were generally good, actually. It was quite nice. And then the whole thing would get excited, but the poor DJs are sitting around, especially on the breakfast shows, looking at what their ratings are, which is what the Rajars are. How did you feel about that?
Oh, I hated it. Fucking hated it. Partially because I'm a bit ADD, right? So I'm not very good with figures. I'm not very good with detail. I'm a generalist. And so the minute that your boss would ring up and he'd be like, okay, so share year on year or something, which is great. You've gone down 136,000, but that's good because year on year, it means that the general trend is, I'm like, you lost me on the first sentence. And now I'm not listening to you. I'm just panicking, you know. I hated all that. And the story I always tell about this and about the usual metrics of success, like you say in radio, Rajars and Sonys, as they were called, we got fucking nowhere with that. We were like, our general trend on breakfast was up. You know, we always did all right because the whole station was going up because month on month, year on year, more and more people were getting into DAB. So it was a slowly growing thing. And some months we do really well. We never really caught Lamac. I think we were number one once. But again, they always used to say, but it's not linear listening, DAB, you see. People don't listen like they do to FM, so you're doing very well. So we were like, okay, as long as you don't sack us. But then, and then they did. But like in 2009, the closest I got to a bauble tin was we got nominated for Best Breakfast Show. And we couldn't believe what? We were going to the Grosvenor. I fucking got my suit out of the mothballs. We turned up. We couldn't believe it. And the nearest I've ever had to an accolade in radio is that we came fourth or fifth that year in Best Breakfast Show. So we don't know which because they only did gold, silver and bronze. Right. So we were like fourth or fifth in 2009, which I'm going to get on a fucking T-shirt.
None of it really matters, though. As I always say, it's when you get a text or an email or, you know, the last week of your broadcasting when everybody was outpouring love, that means so much more. When anyone sends me even like an email to this or a text or something, a tweet, sorry, to this podcast, I get such a buzz out of it. And I've won a couple of awards in my time and I don't get as much buzz out of that as I do the actual listener or viewer replying to me. Christian O'Connell, by the way, on the show, he won loads. I mean, he just won ridiculous amounts. And he always had that massive rivalry with Chris Moyles. And Chris, he says this in my podcast, Chris Moyles at one stage said to him, you've got more Sony than listeners, more Sonys than listeners. Which just really amused me because he said we probably did. All right, listen, we're running out of time. Let's just see if we can get through a couple more of these. How's your mental health? I like to ask that to people.
It's up and down like a bride's nighter, to be honest. It really is. It's mine's affected like most people. I think that unless you are a sociopath, and there are quite a few of them out there, most of them are kind of running our lives, you know, government or or in big corporations, not the BBC, I hasten to add. That's not a dig at the BBC. I just mean generally, you know, it's sociopathy is the thing right now, and that seems to be massively rewarded. It doesn't now feel like the bad guys have been winning these last few years with one thing and another. So when you're a bit of a sensitive soul or an arsehole like me, like us, we're creative people, right? And if you're creative in general, I think, I'm being very general, but I think that people who are creative tend towards the sensitive. That's one of the reasons that they're drawn to it, because they've got a slightly thinner membrane, slightly thinner skin, actually, because they can feel what you're feeling. That's why actors are good. That's why musicians are good a lot of the time. That's why artists of any kind are good. Not that I'm putting myself up there with Picasso or Stevie Wonder.
That's what I'm hearing.
This guy's a fucking fool. You know, anybody who's a bit creative, they've got that thinner membrane, I think, a lot of the time. And it's ironic then that they're often working in the toughest industries a lot of the time. So because of that, my mental health can vary a little bit. And I can get, I need quiet, actually. I'm quite an introverted person, believe it or not. And if I don't get enough peace and quiet and time to myself, then it starts to suffer. But I've got an amazing wife and amazing kids and an amazing big family and friends. So I'm always okay, you know, because they're always there. So yeah. And if you weren't there, I'd be totally fucked. So I'm all right.
I was just having a think this morning before this chat, and I was thinking there was a period of time where I didn't listen to you, and it was because I went off you, but because I was going through depression a few years ago, and I find music so ridiculously powerful that, and people think I'm weird for this, I've spoken to a couple of my friends, that I have to switch it off because it's too much input into my and I can't listen to it. It's conjuring up too many memories, and anyone who's had depression will understand that you're trying to protect yourself from things coming into you that will make it feel worse. So you end up pushed away a lot of TV as well, anything nostalgic I had to get rid of. And the problem with Six Music there is nostalgic music on there all the time, and for me that was too much. And music's such a powerful tool to work with, don't you think?
Yeah, and it is. And funnily enough, what you've just said, I'm sorry to hear that, because we've all been, many of us have been through these episodes, haven't we? And it's fucking hard to get through. But I did one of my lineup interviews was with Shappy Khorsandi, the comedian, and that was an emotional one. And she talks about, and she won't mind me mentioning it because she mentioned it on the podcast, when she and her husband went their separate ways, she couldn't listen to music for 2 years.
Yeah.
She just couldn't listen to music at all for 2 years. And it was actually Elbow that pulled her out in the end. After a couple of years, she sort of resurfaced and breathed again, you know. But that, you're right, music is unbelievably powerful, isn't it?
I was going through a stage, and there's a few records actually, but the album by MGMT, which was massive at a time,
and spectacular,
yeah, and that for some reason doesn't sit well with me. Often I'm all right with it now, but often I remember it would, one of the songs from it would come on and I'd run to the radio and try and get it off, get the radio off, get anything off, because I just knew it was gonna,
yeah,
you know, break. Yeah. Yeah, shake things up again. I can't be arsed. So yeah, it's fascinating. Sean, it's been lovely speaking to you. We got through quite a few of those questions, not 15, but I didn't expect to. The final question, though, I like to ask people of wisdom, and you're one of those. The bonus question, what is the meaning of life?
Oh, fuck. God. That's it. I think that we've sort of touched on it. I remember having this conversation with somebody years ago, and it's like, I'm a lapsed Catholic and wish I believed in something afterwards, but I'm agnostic at best. But when I hear great music, or I see great art, or I see people doing beautiful things for each other, i.e. an expression of love, then it's like, that's heaven. You're in heaven. You actually are. You know, that's the nearest we're ever going to get to this transcendental spiritual thing. No wonder people think God exists, because if you hear a fucking amazing piece of music, or you're with friends and it's, or your family, and you're just in a perfect moment of beauty, that's what the meaning of life is, isn't it? So, and it's there, it's available to us all the time, and it's a beautiful thing to experience.
Love it. Thanks, Sean. Thanks for joining me today. If you want to follow Sean, you'd spend a lot of time on Twitter. That's the best place to go, isn't it? And you're going to be promoting all your podcast stuff on there, aren't you?
I definitely will be plumbing it to the depths. Join me, please. Thank you so much, Tim. It's been really nice to chat to you again.
Cheers, Sean. Thank you so much.